ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good evening and welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, the Victorian Liberal Party elects its first female leader ahead of next year's state election. Also, as the UN Security Council backs Donald Trump's Gaza peace plan, an Australian doctor describes the dire conditions in the enclave. And why are young Australian men competing in local fight clubs?
There's men out there that enjoy punching other men, and being punched in the face is a form of therapy. It is no different to someone who likes to swim or paint or drink wine at the beach with their friend. It's no different.
First this evening, Australia's National Science Agency, the CSIRO, has announced it's slashing up to 350 jobs from its research teams. Its chief executive maintains the cuts are necessary to, quote, sharpen the focus on key areas of research, including energy, climate change and critical minerals. Dr. Doug Hilton also says the rising costs of running a modern science agency mean changes are needed. Reporter Lily Nothling is following the story. Lily, what more can you tell us about what the CSIRO has announced today?
Well, the CSIRO has announced it will slash between 300 and 350 full-time equivalent jobs, and it's essentially grappling with long-term financial challenges. The organisation says it's reached what it's called a critical inflection point, with current funding failing to keep pace with the rising costs of running a modern science agency. We know that these roles will be cut across the country. We're not sure where they'll be cut from at this stage, but essentially the cuts have come off the back of an 18-month review into the research portfolio at the CSIRO, which has found that it needs a sharper focus on areas like climate resilience, clean energy, and advanced technologies.
And is there any more information on what kind of jobs will be cut, what fields they're in?
So engagement and consultation will kick off tomorrow with staff. So we are still waiting on further details about where these jobs will come from. But we know that about 6,000 people are employed by the CSIRO at sites across the country. So again, waiting for detail on where those cuts will come from.
And has there been any reaction as yet to the news that about 350 jobs will go?
Yeah, the reaction has come in quite swiftly this afternoon. The CSIRO Staff Association has slammed the decision, describing it as a very sad day for publicly funded science in Australia, saying that some of the worst cuts the CSIRO has seen. Of course, we know already that more than 800 positions were slashed at the CSIRO in the past 18 months. So the Staff Association says this is further salt in the wound and will really make a big impact on the way that Australia can contribute to science internationally. We've also had comment from David Pocock, Senator for the ACT, who said that locally here in Canberra, more than 1,000 Canberrans work at the CSIRO and they deserve better than ongoing job cuts and uncertainty. But as we know, we don't know yet where those jobs will be cut from. It's very much an evolving situation.
Lily Nothling reporting for us from Canberra. The Victorian Liberal Party has a new leader, with just 12 months to go until the next state election. 35-year-old Jess Wilson becomes the first woman to lead the Libs in Victoria after winning a party room leadership contest against Brad Batten this morning. Discontent had been growing about his performance as opposition leader and failure to score points against the ageing Labor government. Ms. Wilson's victory sets up an all-female contest for Victorian Premier. Rachel Mealy filed this report.
As the bells rang in Victoria's Parliament, history unfolded. Fresh from her party room victory, newly crowned opposition leader Jess Wilson shook the hand of the Premier, Jacinta Allen. Over the ruckus, Jacinta Allen shouted, "Hello, Jess, welcome aboard." It's the first time both major parties in Victoria have been led by a woman.
I was elected unopposed in the Liberal Party room this morning with a clear mandate to take us to the next election to provide that credible alternative government and provide a clear choice to Victorians, 16 years of Labor or a new generational Liberal team that will provide hope for the future.
Jess Wilson is the third opposition leader in the state in 11 months, but she says today represents a new day for her party.
I know that we, the Liberal Party, can deliver for Victorians and that we must win the next election. That is why I put my hand up today. The next election is an absolute moment for Victorians to decide, do they want more of the same tired government or do they want a new generational team that is going to be in their corner, that is going to back them in and deliver for them and their best interests. That's why I put up my hand today and that's why I'm proud to leave our party room and lead my colleagues to the next election.
With just 1 year until the next election, Jess Wilson says her team will focus on what matters to Victorians.
Whether that is stopping the crime crisis in this state, whether it is actually ensuring they can get access to timely healthcare, whether it is making sure that we get on top of the spiralling debt situation in this state. Because as we see that net debt grow, that interest repayment will grow and grow and grow, and it will become simply unsustainable to invest in essential services.
Charlotte Mortlock is Executive Director of the Hilmers Network, which seeks to recruit women to the Liberal Party.
So I think it addresses some of the issues with getting females into these positions of power. I think that that is a fantastic look for a modern political party. But of course, we don't expect that just putting a female leader in is going to bring back the female vote overnight. It is going to come down to policy. We know that is the most important thing to voters.
Paul Strangio is Emeritus Professor in Politics at Monash University. He says Jess Wilson's biggest challenge will be uniting a deeply divided party.
The Victorian Liberal Party has now whirled through 10 changes of leader since Jeff Kennett relinquished the role shortly after his government's fall at the end of 1999. And the average tenure of those leaders has been, you know, a little less than 3 years. So this has been a chronic ongoing problem in the party, that of leadership instability. And I think there's lots of challenges, therefore, before Jess Wilson that are linked to that.
But he says with 12 months to go until the election, Jess Wilson is in with a chance of becoming Premier.
Well, look, she's got one great advantage working for her. She's up against a government that Victorians are tired of after 10 years in office and which has significant problems, millstones around it now, such as debt, crime waves and so on.
Mark Civitella is a lecturer in political communication at La Trobe University who's worked with the ALP in Victoria.
She's at least being able to present something which is different and fresh to the voting public in Victoria, which may give them some purchase going forward.
By the end of the week, there may be another woman leading the opposition in another state. In New South Wales, rumours persist that Liberal Party leader Mark Speakman will face a challenge from MP Kelly Sloan. But on the federal stage, Shadow Home Affairs Minister Jonathan Dunningham says leader Susan Lee is safe from a spill motion.
I'd be very surprised if there was a leadership spill. I reckon I can guarantee you that.
That's federal Liberal MP Jonathan Dunningham. That report from Rachel Mealy. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. The United Nations Security Council has voted in favour of Donald Trump's Gaza peace plan in New York today. The resolution endorses the establishment of a temporary international stabilisation force for the enclave, but Hamas has rejected the resolution, saying the plan doesn't satisfy the rights and demands of Palestinians. Tanya Dendrinos prepared this report.
I shall put the draft resolution to the vote now.
A UN Security Council resolution based on a Gaza peace plan announced by Donald Trump back in September. Prior to the vote in New York, the US ambassador to the UN, Mike Waltz, sold the plan to his fellow members.
For two agonizing years, Gaza, home to over 2 million souls, has been a crucible of conflict a hell on earth.
He suggested the US draft resolution promises hope.
Per the carefully negotiated language in the 20-point plan, this resolution charts a possible pathway for Palestinian self-determination after the Palestinian Authority has completed the necessary reforms, where rockets will give way to olive branches and there is a chance to agree on a political horizon.
It was adopted with 13 votes in favour of the resolution and none against. Algeria currently sits on the Security Council. Its ambassador to the UN is Amar Benjama.
We acknowledged the efforts undertaken by President Trump in advancing peace worldwide, but we underline that genuine peace in the Middle East cannot be achieved without justice. Justice for the Palestinian people who have waited for decades for the establishment of their independent state.
The resolution calls for the establishment of a board of peace as a transitional administration in Gaza to coordinate reconstruction efforts. The board of peace will also establish a temporary international stabilization force. The UN says countries will contribute personnel to the force in close consultation and cooperation with Egypt and Israel. Both Russia and China, who are permanent members of the Security Council, abstained from the vote. China's ambassador to the UN is Fu Kong.
The draft resolution is vague and unclear on many critical elements. The pen holder requests the Council to authorize the establishment of a Board of Peace and International Stabilization Force, which will play a key role in a post-war governance in Gaza. It should have explained in detail their structure, composition, terms of reference, and criteria of preparation, among others.
The resolution also suggested Israeli forces would fully withdraw from Gaza once the forces established security and operational control across the territory, and references the future possibility of Palestinian statehood, which Israel strongly opposes. Aaron David Miller is a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and a former Middle East negotiator.
Donald Trump has achieved something that is quite remarkable. He's internationalized the Gaza component of the Israeli-Palestinian problem. That is something that has never happened in the history of Arab-Israeli, Israeli-Palestinian peacemaking. And through the back door, he's basically endorsed Palestinian self-determination.
But he says the adoption of a resolution and its realization are very different.
Demilitarization is not so subtle, not subtle at all. It's an effort to put Hamas out of business. So they're going to be very reluctant, and the Arab states are going to be very, very reluctant to deploy their forces when they face the possibility of confronting Palestinians, and even worse, I think, or at least as bad, basically holding Israel's coat while the Israelis kill Palestinians. Those two things are not tenable.
Hamas has rejected the UN Security Council resolution, insisting it won't disarm. In a statement, the militant group said the resolution imposes an international guardianship mechanism on the Gaza Strip, which our people and their factions reject.
Tanya Dendrinos. Well, from the actions of the Security Council in New York to the view on the ground in Gaza, an Australian emergency doctor working there is warning the conditions for Palestinians are still dire, despite the fragile ceasefire being in place. Brisbane's Dr. Tien Min Din is working with MSF, that's Doctors Without Borders, at a field hospital in central Gaza. A warning, you may find some of the details in this story distressing. Speaking from the hospital, she told me the Gaza ceasefire is doing little, if anything, to protect Palestinians.
It's meant to be a ceasefire, but it's not. In my opinion, this is still a genocide that's been disguised as a ceasefire. There have been hundreds of civilians who have been killed since the ceasefire started, and many, many hundreds more who have been injured.
Dr. Din, why do you think that's happening?
I think what's happened with the ceasefire is that the Israeli forces have, and the Israeli authorities have, courted a ceasefire to placate their political allies so that they can continue restricting aid, continue killing Palestinians, and they can continue removing the conditions that are needed for life. An example is that 5 minutes ago, I was seeing a patient in ICU. So he was collecting firewood for his family and they shot him many times. So he has come in with a liver laceration, a collapsed lung, blood in his chest. He's come in with his large intestine and small intestine just riddled with holes.
What are the chances that he'll survive?
Despite how unwell he was and despite our lack of resources, we're fortunate in that our surgeons are incredibly skilled. They've stabilized him. He's still in a critical condition in ICU, but I think this particular patient will make it. But unfortunately, I can't say the rest or the hundreds of Palestinians who have been killed since the ceasefire started.
Tell us more about what an average working day is like for you at the moment. What sort of cases are you seeing?
So we're still seeing, one, an overwhelming amount of cases of people who have been and are currently being injured. But what we are also seeing are hundreds of patients with complications from previous injuries. One of our patients at the moment is a 10-year-old girl who was a triple amputee. She, a few months ago, was walking down the street with her cousin when an Israeli drone spotted them and it dropped a bomb on them. When she woke up in ICU, she was missing one arm. She was missing both legs and her cousin was dead. Her story is not unique. We hear it every day. And despite all of this, the Israelis are still placing restrictions on things that we can bring in. There are restrictions on crutches and there are restrictions on wheelchairs.
What explanation are you being given for that restriction of supply?
Israeli authorities really aren't offering any valid explanation as to why they're restricting our supplies. MSF has actually not seen an increase in the amount of aid that we're bringing in after the ceasefire. In fact, in the last week, they have turned away three of our trucks that were carrying just aged medical equipment, water and sanitation items. They tore apart one of those trucks and destroyed 11 of the pallets within those trucks that were carrying baby formula. And there is no valid explanation that they are giving us. There's no valid explanation anyone can give for destroying baby formula.
Did you witness that yourself?
I did not, but that came through from the reports of our supply officers and our pharmacy team.
Dr. Din, you mentioned that little girl who's tragically lost three limbs. We, of course, hear back in Australia that people who've returned home in Gaza or perhaps just moved around a lot are living in very difficult conditions. Tell us about those conditions and how it affects people who've been badly injured.
So they are living in tents, and I use the word tents very lightly. They are shelters made from pipes that have been found and from plastics. These people don't have any electricity, they don't have access to reliable water, and they don't have reliable access to food. They do seek treatment in hospital, but they have to walk kilometres to seek that treatment. Often we don't have the medications, the first-line antibiotics that are needed to treat their injuries and the complications. They just can't heal because when patients are malnourished, beyond seeing them look like skeletons, they don't have the proteins that they need. They don't have the sugars, the micronutrients, the selenium and zinc needed for their body to actually lay down tissue. So one of our chronic patients has had about 10 surgeries. He, again, was injured in an airstrike while he was trying to save someone else's life. Every time we go in to sew him up, we sew him up and then a week later, a couple of weeks later, his intestine just doesn't heal and it just leaks everywhere.
We're hearing about this yellow line under the ceasefire, which Gazans must stay within. Are you finding that is a particularly dangerous place for Gazans to be?
Yes. It's dangerous, one, because it's not clearly demarcated. So these Palestinians who don't have access to the news, the internet, will hear that there's a ceasefire and they will go back to these lines or close to it to see what they can collect from their homes. Like the patient I mentioned before, he's gone to see if he can collect firewood for his families and they're being killed at these lines. There was a family of 12 who were in a van in the north who were killed only a couple of weeks ago.
So what is MSF urging the Israeli government and perhaps the world community to do to improve the conditions for people in Gaza and improve the conditions under which you're working?
I would like Australians to know that this isn't a ceasefire. I would like Australians to know that this is still a genocide that's been disguised as a ceasefire. And I would urge politicians and policymakers to demand that the Israeli government allow access, allow aid in, with unimpeded restrictions to that aid. And I would demand that the Israeli authorities stop killing Palestinians.
That's Brisbane Dr. Tianmin Din. She was speaking to me from an MSF field hospital in central Gaza. She's leading the medical team there and is on her second three-month stint in the enclave this year. And we point out that the government of Israel denies it's committing genocide in Gaza. Doctors, lawmakers and even some athletes are raising concerns about the rise of amateur fighting competitions around Australia. The ABC's 730 program has gained rare access to the clubs to see how they work and what motivates people to join in. Miles Holbrook-Walk has the story.
In a relatively innocuous gym on the Gold Coast, an almighty fury is about to be unleashed.
The way the judges score is based on aggression and front foot forward and just volume in total.
This is the Hood Contender, a spin-off combat sport created this year by founder Caleb Valeri. He says this hand-to-hand combat is an essential outlet for men's mental health.
There's men out there that enjoy punching other men and being punched in the face as a form of therapy. It is no different to someone who likes to swim or paint or drink wine at the beach with their friend. It's no different.
Stephen Gardner is among the fighters and is adamant this is a worthy outlet.
Drugs, alcohol, it's all around us in the hood. Finding a gym keeps us disciplined, keeps us straight, keeps us going. I need things to keep me going the right way, keeping those demons away.
The rules can vary tournament to tournament, but essentially people step into a ring that has hay bales instead of ropes and fight in a smaller than usual space to ensure more combat and more big blows. Caleb Valeri explains some of the rules.
So it's stand-up boxing, hand-to-hand combat, no kicking, no grappling, none of that. So it's pure boxing with MMA gloves. It's fast, it's electric.
When 730 attends the group's first ever ticketed event, it sees an at times brutal and confronting sport.
Yeah, of course. You know, some boys get caught and they get dropped and they're unconscious for a few seconds there, but we have medics on standby, we have doctors, ambulance, stuff that, so we book that out of our own money. Yeah.
So there's a doctor here today?
Yeah, no, he will be here today, yes.
But throughout the night, we weren't able to see or speak to any of these medical professionals. So we asked Caleb Valeri again, where were they?
It's difficult. Like, some people don't want to be associated. We have people who are behind the scenes who don't want to be associated with.
Do you worry some people will then think, how can we know it's safe kind of thing?
Is violence safe? You know, at the end of the day, it's a violent act. Like, you don't know any one punch can change your life.
So is this sort of sport even legal? Sports lawyer Tim Fuller explains it depends on where you are.
So all of the states in Australia have their own legislation that governs events, and there's an authority that either approves or rejects applications for events. Now in Queensland and the Northern Territory, there's no legislation. So what that means is events are left up to the rules and the governing bodies of respective sports.
The Hood Contender hasn't obtained approval by any combat sport authority to run an event. Associate Professor Michael Buckland is a neuropathologist at the Royal Prince Alfred Hospital in Sydney.
I find it deeply disturbing. This is a sport, like several others, that one of its main purposes is to cause a mild traumatic brain injury on your opponent. That's how you knock them out.
Michael Buckland studies brain injuries caused by concussion and head impacts. He and other experts say there's a growing body of work showing combat sports are not safe.
Unfortunately, what we're seeing now is proliferation of these less regulated combat sports. I'm not convinced that in this case that the organisers have done everything to mitigate the risks.
The Queensland government told the ABC,
while the combat sports sector in Queensland is self-regulated, we will continue to work with the sporting industry to promote best practice and support safety within the sector.
Whatever objections, moral, medical or legal, Caleb Valeri isn't stopping.
I wanted the biggest UFC one day. Yeah. A lot of people laugh at that. A lot of people will go, oh yeah, whatever, mate. But it's true and it will happen one day. Just depends, you know. It's like ladders, mate. Just got to climb and keep climbing and digging. That's all I've got to do, but eventually one day.
amateur fight organiser Caleb Valeri. Miles Holbrook-Walk with that report. And you can see more on that story on the 7:30 program on ABC TV tonight, or of course on iView. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. The podcast of the full program is available on the ABC Listen app. And we'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. As you would have seen, the Liberals and Nationals have now officially dumped net zero emission targets from their climate and energy policy. It keeps the coalition together. But what do voters think? Today, pollster, former Labor strategist and director of the Redbridge Group, Cos Samaras, on whether it's a winning strategy. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.